Happy Friday, everyone. It's time to read the Fort Dodge Messenger for Friday, January 17th, 2020. We are reading to you from our studio located at Friendship Haven in Fort Dodge. My name is Ruth, and my partner at the microphone is Skip. We're glad to have you listening. We will start with a look at today's weather and headlines from the front page.
Good morning. Today's weather, there's supposed to be a high of 26, a low tonight of 12. Expect snow mixed with freezing rain and a southeast wind 15 to 20 mile an hour. Our headlines for the day: by a single bright light, students participate in Read by Flashlight event at Butler Elementary. Winter storm to hit central Iowa today. Trump's trial begins. Senators vow impartial justice. Eagle Grove calls special election for vacancy, and the winter storm may cause Saturday papers to be delayed.
And now our first article, by a single bright light. The students attending the annual Dodger Academy Read by Flashlight Thursday afternoon had their choice of three different levels of illumination. There was the library with dimmed lights, the cafeteria with bright lights, and the gym, completely dark. One of those, with a nod to a certain story with three bears in it, would be just right. Dan Harris and his daughter, Leah Harris, 7, opted for a flashlight in the gym. "It's cool," she said. "We did it last year." She enjoyed a National Geographic book on sea otters. They use their stomachs for plates. They smash food on rocks, and they can hold their breath for 5 minutes, she said. She also learned about their groups called rafts. "So the rafts are either all girls or all boys," she said. Also, she discovered they're not good pets. "No," she said, "its teeth are super big." Her dad is a strong proponent of reading with his daughter. "Every night we read a book," he said. He's also made sure there's a well-stocked library. "How many books do you think we have?" he asked her. "Apparently plenty, but not the right ones. I want to get rid of them. They're all about imaginary animals," she said. "We need more about real animals. I like real ones." Her brother, Corey Harris, 11 months, reclined in his car seat nearby. She's nicknamed him Corn Dog. According to her own observations, he's learning on his own. "He's learned to stick out his tongue and to spit," she said. Tina Brown read with her granddaughter, Nayla Brown, 7, and Brown's friend, Kylie Mosley, 8. They found a seat in the gym. "I like graphic novels," Mosley said. "I like movie books," Brown said. "Grandma has her own taste." "You like nonfiction books and you like cooking books," Brown said. They also read a lot at home and are frequent visitors to the library. Montana Peterson, 8, opted for the dimmed lights of the library, where she also had the company of Jordan and Snoopy, 2 therapy dogs, brought along by Marianne Rowe and Terry Haas, both of Fort Dodge. Peterson doesn't have a favorite genre. "I just like the one I'm reading at the moment," Peterson said. She's also no stranger to reading to dogs. "Sometimes we go to my cousin's house and they have a dog we read to," she said. "Her name is Sadie." Aaron Brookshire, the director of Dodger Academy program, said that the program's extra reading efforts, along with Butler's extra efforts, have resulted in an improvement in the students' recent test scores. She said there are plenty of benefits to reading: relaxation, reducing stress, and continuing to learn among them. She also said that students who read at home with their parents also do better in school. All of the books read Thursday were donated by the Kiwanis Club. Each child got to keep their volume. All of the students were able to take home the book they read, Brookshire said.
Winter storm to hit central Iowa today. Much of Iowa will be hit with its first major winter storm of the season today and tomorrow. The National Weather Service in Des Moines has issued a winter storm warning to go into effect at 9 a.m. today and will run to at least 6 p.m. Saturday. The National Weather Service predicts up to 6 inches of snow in the north-central Iowa region, with other outlets predicting anywhere from 5 to 8 inches of snow, as well as some ice accumulation. The Iowa State Patrol works with the Iowa Department of Transportation, watching the weather forecast and preparing for storms. In Iowa, things kind of change hour by hour, so we just monitor it constantly, said Lieutenant Mark Miller of the Iowa State Patrol District Number 7. Miller said the Iowa State Patrol is looking at having troopers on standby in case they need to call in extra support over the weekend, or if troopers on duty can take a longer shift. While public safety personnel and law enforcement generally prefer citizens stay home and off the roads during these storms like the one expected this weekend, Miller says that if someone thinks that they absolutely have to drive somewhere, they need to look at the risk versus the reward if they do. Where are you trying to get to and what are you going to accomplish by getting there, he said, versus the risk to your life and your personal safety or your family's safety. So I wouldn't go unless you need to go somewhere. If it's something that you can't put off, if it's something you can put off, put it off. Miller said that if a person does decide that they need to drive during the storm, they need to remember to be patient and expect delays, so they should give themselves extra time. He also advised traveling only during daylight and to have a detour or an alternate route planned out in case of an incident like a jackknife semi blocking the roadway for an extended period of time. And don't be afraid if you have to start out on your journey and turn around if you think it's too bad, Miller added. Drive slow and increase following distance, Miller also advises drivers. When you get icy conditions out, it's going to take you longer to stop, and then you come across a problem, he said. Set yourself up for success. Slow down and give yourself a little bit of following time. Miller said that on highways during winter weather, the cars slow down to 35 or 40 miles an hour, or even less. Usually, they don't end up in the ditch. It's usually the cars that think that they can go the speed limit because they have all-wheel drive or four-wheel drive, and they're the ones that you usually find in the ditches later. Miller also warns against using cruise control in slick road condition. Drivers should prepare for the possibility they may end up in a ditch or off the road when driving during heavy snowstorms, the lieutenant said. Help may not be able to arrive right away, so he recommends keeping blankets or sleeping bags for warmth in the vehicle, as well as flashlights, fully charged cell phones, water, and food. Pay attention to where you are at all times, so if you do end up in the ditch, you have an idea of your location when you call 911, Miller said. Miller also suggests keeping a shovel in your vehicle just in case. Sometimes you can dig yourself out of a problem, he said. In addition to the several inches of snow predicted for Friday and Saturday, the National Weather Service also expects freezing rain in the late afternoon and into the evening on Friday, producing up to a tenth of an inch of ice, another hazard to drivers. Keep your windshields clear, Miller warned. Ice can obscure visibility when driving. It's okay to pull over every once in a while to clear your windshield, but don't do it on an interstate system or a busy highway. Try to find an exit ramp or something off the main portion or to clear those windshields if you have to. Due to the weather, classes at Fort Dodge Public Schools and parochial schools will be closed today.
Trump's trial begins. Senators vowing impartial justice. Washington, D.C. The U.S. Senate opened the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump with quiet ceremony Thursday. Senators standing at their desks to swear an oath of impartial justice as jurors. House prosecutors formally reciting the charges and Chief Justice John Roberts presiding. The trial, only the third such undertaking in American history, is unfolding at the start of the election year, a time of deep political division in the nation. Four of the senators sitting in judgment on Trump are running for the Democratic Party's nomination to challenge him in the fall. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, intoned the Senate's sergeant at arms, calling the proceedings to order just past noon. Senators filled the chamber, an unusual sight in itself, sitting silently under strict rules that prohibit talking or cell phones for a trial that will test not only Trump's presidency, but also the nation's three branches of power and its system of checks and balances. The Constitution mandates the Chief Justice serve as the presiding officer, and Roberts made the short trip across the street from the Supreme Court to the Capitol. He has long insisted judges are not politicians and is not expected to serve as a referee for the proceedings. Senators rose quickly when he appeared at his plain black robe. Will all senators now stand and remain standing and raise their right hand, Roberts said. Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial in the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help you God? The senators responded they would, and then they lined up to sign an oath book. Trump faces two charges after the House voted to impeach him last month. One, that he abused his presidential power by pressuring Ukraine to investigate Democratic rival Joe Biden, using military aid to the country as leverage. Trump is also charged with obstructing Congress in suing probe. The president insists he did nothing wrong, and he dismissed the trial anew on Thursday at the White House. It's totally partisan. It's a hoax. Eventual acquittal is expected in the Republican-controlled Senate. However, new revelations are mounting about Trump's actions toward Ukraine. The Government Accountability Office said Thursday that the White House violated federal law in withholding the security assistance to Ukraine, which shares a border with hostile Russia. At the same time, an indicted associate of Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, Lev Parnas, has turned over to prosecutors new documents linking the president to the shadow foreign policy being run by Giuliani. The developments applied fresh pressure to senators to call more witnesses for the trial, a main source of contention that is still to be resolved. The White House has instructed officials not to comply with subpoenas from Congress requesting witnesses or other information. What is the president hiding? What is he afraid of? Asked Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer. The gravity of these charges is self-evident, he said. The House of Representatives has accused the president of trying to shake down a foreign leader for personal gain. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the new information from Parnas demands an investigation, which she doesn't expect from Trump's attorney general. This is an example of all of the president's henchmen, and I hope that the senators do not become part of the president's henchmen. Before the swearing-in, House Democrats prosecuting the case stood before the Senate and Republican Adam Schiff of the Intelligence Committee formally read the articles of impeachment. Seven lawmakers, led by Schiff and Representative Gerald Nadler of the Judiciary Committee, made the solemn walk across the Capitol for the second day. All eyes were on Schiff as he stood at a lectern in the well of the chamber, a space usually reserved for senators. House Resolution 755, impeaching Donald John Trump, President of the United States, for high crimes and misdemeanors, he began, reading the nine pages. The other House prosecutor stood in a row to his side. Senator said later that when Roberts appeared, the solemnity of the occasion took hold. Security was tight at the Capitol. I thought this is a historic moment, and you could have heard a pin drop, said Republican John Cornyn of Texas. And so I think the gravity of what our undertaking, I think, was sinking in all of us. Republican House Majority Leader Mitch McConnell took a far different view of the charges and proceedings. He opened the chamber decrying Pelosi's decision to hand out souvenir pens on Wednesday after she signed the resolution to transmit the charges to the Senate. This final display neatly distilled the House's entire partisan process into one perfect visual, McConnell said. It was a transparently partisan process from beginning to end. GOP Senator James Inhofe was absent, home in Oklahoma for a family medical issue, but plans to take the oath when he returns as the full trial begins next week, his office said. The Senate will issue a formal summons to the White House to appear with the president's legal team expected to respond by Saturday. Opening arguments will begin on Tuesday. The president suggested recently that he would be open to a quick vote to simply dismiss the charges, but sufficient Republican support is lacking for that. Instead, the president's team expects a trial lasting no more than 2 weeks, according to senior administration officials. That would be far shorter than the trial of President Bill Clinton in 1999 or the first one of President Andrew Johnson in 1868. Both were acquitted. It would take a supermajority of senators, 67 of the 100, to convict the president. Republicans control the chamber, 53-47, but it takes just 51 votes during the trial to approve rules, call witnesses, or dismiss the charges. A group of four Republican senators is working to ensure there will be votes on the possibility of witnesses, though it's not at all certain a majority will prevail for new testimony. Since Susan Collins of Maine, Mitt Romney of Utah, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Lamar Alexander of Tennessee are among those involved. I tend to believe having additional information would be helpful, Collins said in a statement. It is likely that I would support a motion to call witnesses. Romney said he wants to hear from John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor at the White House, who others have said raised alarms about the alternative foreign policy toward Ukraine being run by Giuliani. The House managers are a diverse group of legal, law enforcement, and military experience, including Hakeem Jeffries of New York, Sylvia Garcia of Texas, Val Demings of Florida, Jason Crow of Colorado, and Zoe Lofgren of California.
Eagle Grove calls special election for vacancy. Election winner did not want to serve. Eagle Grove City Council has given the okay to move forward in a special election to fill Ward 3 seat after its winner refused. The seat previously held by Denny Van Walter, who served on the City Council for two terms since 2012, was won by Gary Lawler Jr., who did not want the seat. Lawler missed the deadline to pull his name out of the hat before the November election, leaving his name as the only one printed on the ballot. He declared his intent not to serve, giving the City Council permission on its January 6th meeting to declare the seat vacant and schedule another election. Ward 3 voters on the southwestern side of the city can choose their next representative on March 3rd, assuming anybody wants the position. Eagle Grove has four wards and two at-large positions on the City Council. City Administrator Bryce Davis said one person has requested the paperwork necessary to fill out their candidacy. The deadline to file as a candidate is February 5th. The deadline to withdraw from the race as a candidate is February 7th. Lawler could not be reached for comments by press time.
Winter storm may cause Saturday papers to be delayed. An impending winter storm that could bring up to 8 inches of snow and high wind gusts may result in some subscriptions to the Messenger getting their newspapers late on Saturday. The Messenger has an extremely dedicated group of carriers, but a storm like what is predicted will slow even them down. We want our carriers to take their time and be safe. There is a way that print subscribers can get all of the news before their paper is delivered. It is called All Access, and it enables subscribers to read the paper on their computers or phones. For instructions on how to sign up for All Access, please see page 8A for today's edition of the paper.
Next, we'll have the community calendar. And please remember to double check before you go to these meetings to make sure that they're still having them due to the winter weather. The Kossuth County Historical Museum, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. today at the Kossuth County Historical Museum in Algona. Alzheimer's Support Groups, 9:30 to 10:30 a.m., USA Health Center, Clarion. Blandon Memorial Art Museum, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., 920 3rd Avenue South. Admission is free. Rockwell City Rotary Club at noon at the Community Center in Rockwell City. A.A. Alano Club, noon and 8 p.m., 12 North 7th Street. Nickel Bingo, 1 p.m., Multipurpose Room at the Senior Center, Emmitsburg. Fort Dodge Duplicate Bridge Club, 1:30 p.m., open game at Citizen Central. N.A. at 6 p.m. tonight at the Alano Club, 12 North 7th Street. And Jamerotic Artist Freak Base, 8 p.m. tonight at Byron's and Pomeroy. Next, we have this date in history. Today is Friday, January 17th, the 17th day of 2020. There are 349 days left in the year. Today's highlights. On January 17th, 1995, more than 6,000 people were killed when an earthquake with a magnitude of 7.2 devastated the city of Kobe, Japan. On this date, in 1806, Thomas Jefferson's daughter, Martha, gave birth to James Madison Randolph, the first child born in the White House. In 1916, the Professional Golfers Association of America had its beginnings as a department store magnate. Rodman Wanamaker hosted a luncheon of pro and amateur golfers in New York City. The PGA of America was formally established on April 10, 1916. In 1917, Denmark ceded the Virgin Islands to the United States for $25 million. In 1945, Soviet and Polish forces liberated Warsaw during World War II. Sweden diplomat Raoul Wallenberg credited the saving tens of thousands of Jews disappeared in Hungary while the Soviets were in custody. In 1955, the submarine USS Nautilus made its first nuclear-powered test run from its berth in Groton, Connecticut. In 1961, President Dwight D. Eisenhower delivered his farewell address in which he warned against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought by military-industrial complex. In 1977, convicted murderer Gary Gilmore, 36, was shot by a firing squad in the Utah State Prison in the first U.S. execution in a decade. In 1964, the U.S. Supreme Court in Sony Corporation of America versus Universal City Studios ruled 5-4 that the use of home video cassette recorders to tape television programs for private viewing did not violate federal copyright laws. In 1994, a 6.7 magnitude Northridge earthquake struck Southern California, killing at least 60 people, according to the U.S. Geographical Survey. In 1996, Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman and 9 followers were handed long prison sentences for plotting to blow up New York City area landmarks. In 1997, a court in Ireland granted the first divorce in the Roman Catholic country's history. In 2001, faced with an electricity crisis, California used rolling blackouts to cut off power to hundreds of thousands of people. Governor Gray Davis signed the emergency order authorizing the state to buy power. 10 years ago, Pope Benedict XVI paid a visit to Rome, to a Rome synagogue where he and Jewish leaders sparred over World War II era record of Pope Pius XII. 5 years ago, Bill Cosby performed a Welcome Denver, Bill Cosby performed to a welcoming Denver audience. Despite a protest by some 100 people chanting, "Rape is not a joke," and "No means no," outside the theater. 1 year ago, a judge in Chicago acquitted three police officers of trying to cover up the fatal 2014 police shooting of black teenager Laquan McDonald. Thought for the day, the only thing wrong with immorality is that it tends to go on forever.
And now on the opinion page, we have an editorial. Long wait is finally over. Trade deal with China is good for U.S. and great for Iowa. Producing a trade relationship between the United States and China that is fair to both countries and puts an end to Chinese practices that have harmed the American economy has been a major goal of President Donald Trump. During the last 2 years, the ongoing negotiations regarding an improved trade pact created major difficulties for farmers in Iowa and across the nation's heartland. In response to tariffs put in place by the U.S. to put pressure on China, that country's government imposed a variety of retaliatory measures targeting American farmers. A once promising agricultural export situation for Iowa was in jeopardy. The sales to China of corn, soybeans, beef, and pork slowed, and their long-term prospects were in doubt. The long wait for progress on achieving a deal is over. Wednesday, the president signed phase one of an immensely important trade agreement between our nation and China. It addresses a wide range of issues relating to agricultural trade, protection of intellectual property, technology transfers, financial services, currency matters, and expanded U.S. exports. Importantly, it contains key provisions that should help make it an enforceable arrangement. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and U.S. Senators Charles Grassley and Joni Ernst, who have been in constant communication with the president concerning the importance of completing this new trade agreement, were present at the White House for the historic signing of this initial part of what is expected to be a two-part arrangement. Their presence underlined just how crucial the measure is for the Hawkeye State. As Iowa's fourth largest trading partner, China is a critical, important market for Iowans, and this phase one deal, which is especially promising for our ag and manufacturing sectors, will help provide certainty for folks back home, Ernst said in a statement released simultaneously with the signing ceremony. Mike Nagg, who heads the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, underlined the significance of this agreement for Iowa by releasing data on the magnitude of our state's agricultural sales of China. They were already huge before the slowdown that took place during the negotiations. Now they have the possibility of growing enormously. Here are some of the numbers from 2017 and 2018 based on Wiser trade data. Iowa exports to China in 2018 amounted to $415 million of soybeans, $40 million of animal feed, $480,000 of beef, $30 million of pork, and $10 million of corn. Iowa exports to China in 2017 totaled $1.6 billion of soybeans, $15 billion of animal feed, $322,000 of beef, $42 million of pork, and $27 million of corn. And $27 million of corn. China has committed in the phase one arrangement to buy at least $32 million in U.S. agriculture goods in 2020 and 2021. Nagg speculated that those sales might reach $40 million. A significant portion of those exports will come from Iowa. The messenger welcomes this trade deal, a carefully crafted commercial relationship between China and the United States can be a win for both nations. This new China Pact, the congressional approval of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, and a recent trade arrangement with Japan combined to make the years ahead look immensely promising for agriculture. That's wonderful news for Iowans. The hard work that made these trade arrangements possible deserves applause and appreciation.
You are listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. The Messenger can be heard daily at 8 a.m. and 3 p.m. If you have any questions or comments about our program or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. Now we will turn to today's obituaries.
Mary Lois Tice, Clarion. Mary Lois Tice, 93, of Rochester, Minnesota, passed peacefully away on December 30th, 2019, at Samaritan Bethany Home on 8th in Rochester. A gravesite service is planned for Saturday, June 13th, 2020, in Clarion. Mary was born October 11th, 1926, in Clarion, Iowa, to Burr and Mary Nagel, where she lived until moving her junior and senior years of high school to Waterloo, Iowa, graduating from West Waterloo High School. Mary attended AIB in Des Moines, Iowa, and went on to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio, where she worked from the fall of 1944 to the fall of 1948. She also worked many years as a nurse's aide at the hospital in Clarion. On January 8, 1949, Mary married Donald Tice of Clarion. They lived and farmed the family farm near Lake Cornelia until Don retired in the spring of 2006 and they moved into Clarion. Mary moved to an assisted living center in Rochester on January of 2018 to be near her daughter. During her time at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Mary was secretary to the man responsible for coordinating the redesign of the bomb bay in the B-29 that would carry the atomic bomb. Everything was in code, so she was unaware of what she was working on until the morning after the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. She and one other secretary held the highest security clearance possible, as they were responsible for the multiple combination safes holding information. Mary was a very active member of the Clarion Church of Christ over the years and loved hearing from her church family after moving to Rochester. She was also a member of Eastern Star. Mary is survived by her son Greg of Chicago, Illinois, daughter Laurel, Larry Klimp of Rochester, and three granddaughters, Daphne, Daniel Kapik, Anna Trent Hill, and Allie Klimp, and fiancé Drew Brandt, and one great-grandchild. She was preceded in death by her parents and brothers, William Nagel and Burr Nagel Jr., and her husband Don. Memorials to the Clarion Church of Christ are preferred in lieu of flowers.
Esther Jane Thompson. Esther Jane Thompson, 89, of Humboldt, passed away on January 13, 2020 at Humboldt South Care Center. A memorial service will be held on Sunday, January 19th at 1 p.m. at the Mason Linhart Funeral Home. A burial will be held at a later date.
Wilma I. Hare. Wilma I. Hare, 87, of Fort Dodge, passed away on Thursday, January 16, 2020, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice House. Private services held at a later date.
Philip E. Peterson. Philip E. Peterson, 90, passed away Wednesday, January 15, 2020, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home, Fort Dodge. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, January 21st at Our Savior's Lutheran Church calendar with Pastor Greg Sano and Pastor Deb Sano officiating. Burial will be at the Calendar Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Monday, January 20th at Palmer Funeral Home in Gowrie. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Philip is survived by his daughters, Sonia, Dan Johnson of Thompson, and Heidi, Tim Parcell of Norwalk, son TJ, Diane Peterson of Calendar, 6 grandchildren, 14 great-grandchildren, also his brothers Paul, Betty Peterson of Calendar, and David, Evelyn Peterson of Lafayette, Illinois, and other relatives and friends. He was preceded in death by his wife, Marilyn, infant daughters Christine and Nina, and his parents, Percy and Inger Hagen Peterson. Philip E. Peterson was born July 16, 1929, in Calendar. He was raised and educated at Calendar and graduated from Calendar High School with the class of 1948. On April 29, 1951, he was united in marriage to Marilyn Pearson. The couple established their home on a farm near Calendar. Philip farmed and operated a dairy for most of his life. Philip also had a passion for flying. He received his pilot's license and owned his own plane for over 40 years. Philip was a member of Our Savior's Lutheran Church and the Holstein Association.
Nell Bell Wood, Fort Mill, South Carolina. Private family services will be held at a later date. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.brucesfuneralhome.com.
Dorell S. Jackson. A memorial service will be held in Kansas City, Kansas on January 25, 2020. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.brucesfuneralhome.com.
Catherine Louise Hansen, Iowa Falls. Funeral services will be at 2 p.m. Tuesday, Lynn's Funeral Home Chapel, Iowa Falls. Visitation is 1 to 2 p.m. prior to the service at the funeral home.
We have another editorial, A Tangled Web of Deception. When witnesses testify in a courtroom and offer varying, contradictory, or even unlawful explanation of the events under scrutiny, juries tend not to believe them. The same is happening now with the Trump administration's defense of its killing Iranian Major General Soleimani at the use of an unmanned drone while he was being driven peacefully along a public highway in Iraq 2 weeks ago. Why the shifting justifications? Here is a backstory. The general was the commander of Iran's elite military and intelligence forces. He was a fierce opponent of IRIS and the American military presence in Iraq. Iraq and Iran were belligerents for generations owing to, among other factors, ancient disputes among the two main branches of Islam, Shiite and Sunni. For generations, Iran's elites were predominantly Shiite, and Iraqis were predominantly Sunni. When the U.S. under President George W. Bush invaded Iraq in 2002, pursuant to a congressional authorization for use of military force, the government did so by deceiving the American public and Congress into believing it was searching for weapons of mass destruction. Since none was found. But it did not destroy the Sunni government and its true target, the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. That created a power vacuum, which was soon filled by Shiite politicians. Slowly but surely, Iran's and Iraq's government became friendly, and they jointly sponsored militia against ISIS. Soleimani was consulted with President Barack Obama in the Oval Office about using these militia to topple ISIS. The general's assassination was odd, out of place, untimely, and unlawful. Odd because the general's folks had worked with our intelligence folks in Iraq against ISIS. Out of place because the Iranian general was welcomed by the Iraqi government and was not engaged in any violence or war crimes at the time he was killed. untimely because whatever he may have been planning to do was not an imminent attack on U.S. or on Americans. We know this because Trump administrative officials revealed that the president gave the kill order 7 months ago, in June 2019. How imminent could attack have been in June if it had not occurred by January? And unlawful because we are not at war with Iran, and political assassinations have been prohibited by still valid executive orders signed by President Gerald R. Ford and Ronald Reagan. The U.S. Constitution limits the federal government's lawful power to kill a foreign troop in wartime, and due process neither abides here. Moreover, international treaties to which the U.S. is party, as well as the laws of war to which the U.S. subscribes, prohibits preemptive killings except when the target is just about to certainty is the standard to strike. Now back to the shifting sands of justification. Shortly after the general's death, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo argued that Soleimani's attack on Americans was imminent. President Donald Trump himself claimed Soleimani was planning to attack four U.S. embassies in the Middle East. When Secretary of Defense Mark Esper was asked if he saw any intelligence data about attacking four embassies, he said no, he had not. When Pompeo was pressed for his understanding of Trump's embassy claim, he offered that the intelligence data did not reveal where or when or how, but he knew Soleimani was probably up to no good. When the State Department spokesman was asked if any alerts of likely attacks had been sent to any American embassies in the region, she had said none had. When the White House sent CIA Director Gina Haspel, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Mark Miller, and Pompeo and Esper to brief members of Congress on the administration's intelligence, moral, and legal justifications for killing the general, none of the briefers mentioned four embassies or any data showing where or when or how they might have been struck. Just probabilities. When Republican Senators Mike Lee and Rand Paul challenged the briefers, the president weighed in with a startling tweet on Monday. The fake news media and their Democratic partners are working hard to determine whether or not the future attack by terrorist Soleimani was imminent or not. And it was my team's agreement that the answer to both is a strong yes. It does not really matter because of its horrible past. This boast of killing the general because of its horrible past sent off bells and whistles in the Department of Justice. Trump's retribution argument does not legally justify killing a person who is not engaged in violence at the time of the killing, and arguably is not a war crime. Thereupon, Attorney General Bill Barr revealed that the DOJ has consulted on the lawfulness of the killing and signed off on it if the general attacks Americans were imminent. Now, the imminence argument has been undermined by the administration's own folks, including the president himself. The attorney general argued that Soleimani needed to die as a deterrent to others, pursuant to the old 2002 AUMF. These shifting justifications are contrary to reason and cannot survive a simple cross-examination. When did we start killing generals from countries with which we are not at war? Never in our history. When did we start killing foreign generals because of their horrible past? Never in our history. How can government use the 2002 AUMF, whose stated targets was Iraqi WMDs, but whose true target was Saddam Hussein, who is a legal justification to kill a non-Iraqi general 18 years later? Except in the minds of extreme administrative loyalists, it cannot legally or rationally do so. Why is truth always the first casualty of government violence?
Senate passes U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade deal, a Trump priority. Washington, D.C. The Senate overwhelmingly approved a new North American trade agreement Thursday that rewrites the rules of trade with Canada and Mexico and gives President Donald Trump a major policy win before senators turn their full attention to his impeachment trial. The vote was 89-10. The measure goes to Trump for his signature. It would replace the 25-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement known as NAFTA, which tore down most trade barriers and triggered a surge in trade. But Trump and other critics blamed that pact for encouraging U.S. companies to move their manufacturing plants south of the border to take advantage of low-wage Mexican laborers. Passage of the trade bill, which has come to be called USMCA, came one day after Trump signed a new trade agreement with China, easing trade tensions between the economic powers. Quite a week of substantive accomplishments for the nation, for the president, and for our international trade, said Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky, shortly before the vote. A final vote occurred just moments before Congress opened an impeachment trial, with House Democrats reading the formal charges from the well of the Senate. With the trial and an election year, Congress is not expected to pass many major bills. The trade bill gives lawmakers from both parties the chance to cite progress on an important economic issue before the November vote.
Claiming innocence, inmate seeks DNA testing in 1976 slaying. This is from Iowa City. A man who has spent 43 years in prison for a murder his lawyer says his half-brother likely committed is requesting DNA testing on a hunting cap left at the scene of the deadly robbery and shooting in southeast Iowa. Gentrick Hicks, 73, is serving a life sentence for the early morning May 23, 1976 slaying of 28-year-old Jeremy Foster at the Hillcrest Motel near Fort Madison. He is imprisoned at the Anamosa State Penitentiary, where he is considered a model inmate. The Midwest Innocence Project and the Wrongful Conviction Unit of the State Public Defender's Office filed the petition on Hicks' behalf this week. Iowa is one of 13 states that has never had an inmate exonerated by DNA, but tests on previous unexamined crime scene evidence are being sought or underway in several cases dating back decades. Hicks' case is the oldest yet. It is undisputed that the orange cap recently found by defense lawyers after decades of post-trial storage at the Henry County Courthouse in Mount Pleasant came off the killer's head during the scuffle and shooting that killed Foster. Officers recovered it from the scene, but DNA testing didn't exist back then. The crime lab examined the cap for hairs, but couldn't find any. The new testing is ordered by a judge. The question will be whether enough DNA material can be extracted from the inside of the cap to create a profile, and if so, whether it's a match for Hicks. Henry County Attorney Darren Slater said Thursday that prosecutors are reviewing the petition and still deciding how to proceed. Foster lived at the motel, which was owned by his parents. They were white. Foster was shot to death while trying to protect his mother, Lorraine, from a black man who had posed as a middle-of-the-night custodian or customer but had robbed her at gunpoint. The shooter fled on foot. Foster's father, Jimmy, grabbed a rifle and detained the driver of the getaway car outside the motel. The driver, Kenneth Lawrence, initially told Jimmy Foster and police that the shooter was his friend, Willie Jefferson. But within hours, Lawrence changed his statement and said from the jail that the shooter was his acquaintance, Gentrick Hicks, Jefferson's half-brother. Officers never interviewed or investigated Jefferson, who died in 1990. Instead, they immediately arrested Hicks, who was known in the local drug and partying scene and had previously served prison time for robbery. The murder weapon was never found. Lorraine Foster identified Hicks as her son's killer after picking him out of a photo and courtroom lineups that did not include Jefferson. She repeatedly used racial slurs when talking to police, describing Hicks as having the usual black face. A jury convicted Hicks in 1997 after hearing testimony from Lorraine Foster and Lawrence, who had a murder charge against him dropped in exchange for testifying against Hicks. An investigator also testified that fingerprints lifted from a motel door belonged to Hicks, with the chances of anyone else having similar features being 1 in approximately 7 million. Hicks testified that he had been out earlier that night at taverns with Lawrence, that he had eventually passed out from drugs and alcohol and fell asleep at a friend's place. He insisted he had nothing to do with the crime, saying at his sentencing, "I am innocent." The petition alleges that Lorraine Foster's identification of Hicks was unreliable because of the problems with the lineups and her open racial annals. Also, the fingerprint analyst technique is now discredited and today would be considered inconclusive for a match. The petition argues that Lawrence's initial identification of Jefferson as the shooter was credible and only implicated Hicks after he had time to think of a new story. Investigators never checked whether Jefferson had an alibi. They simply couldn't find him, and even though prosecutors were able to subpoena him to testify another case around that time, one agent suggested that Jefferson skipped out of town after a teen runaway committed suicide at his Burlington home.
Expert: Georgia election server shows signs of tampering. A computer security expert says he found that a forensic image of the election server central to the legal battle over the integrity of Georgia elections showed signs that the original server was hacked. The server was left exposed to the open internet for at least 6 months, a problem the same expert discovered in August 2016. It was subsequently wiped clean in mid-2017 with no notice, just days after election integrity activists filed a lawsuit seeking an overhaul of what they call the state's unreliable and negligent run election system. In late December 2019, the plaintiffs were finally able to obtain a copy of the server's contents that the FBI made in March 2017 and retained after the state allegedly dragged its feet in securing the image. State officials have said they've seen no evidence that any election-related data was compromised, but they also long refused to submit the server image for an independent examination. Logan Lamb, a security expert for the plaintiffs, said in an affidavit filed in Atlanta federal court on Thursday that he found evidence suggesting the server was compromised in December 2014. Lamb said the evidence suggests an attacker exploited a bug that provided full control of the server.
Next, we'll have Go and Do. Please remember that due to forecasted severe weather, some events may be canceled or postponed. Please check with www.messengernews.net for updates. First, we have Dueling Pianos. Webster County Fair Committee presents Dueling Pianos of Andy Anderson and Mike Leeds Saturday at the Webster County Fairgrounds. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. Showtime is 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. An hors d'oeuvres buffet will be served from 6:30 to 9 o'clock, and a cash bar will be available. Tickets are $30 per person. Proceeds go to the 2020 Webster County Fair. Reserve tickets by calling 408-3764. Self-Defense for Women. A self-defense program for women 13 years and older is from 8 to 9 a.m. Saturday at Faverlick Martial Arts, 567 South 25th Street. This program will cover the most common threats facing women. Participants will learn some simple and effective techniques using awareness, leverage, and timing to defend yourself and escape from seemingly impossible situations. No experience is necessary. Participants should wear comfortable clothing and workout attire. Pre-registration is required by emailing justin.faferlick@gmail.com. The program is free. More items in Fort Dodge. Soldier Creek Winery, 1584 Paragon, is holding a Vineyard Vibrations from 6 to 8 p.m. today. Free live music to be provided by Chris Carr. Food will be available for purchase. The Blandon Memorial Art Museum at 920 3rd Avenue South is holding youth art classes, Delightful, Delicious, Decorated, Sculptured Cupcakes, Saturday. Class from 6 to 10-year-olds is from 10 a.m. to noon, and classes for 11 to 16-year-olds are from 1 to 3 p.m. There is a limit of 12 students in each session. Cost is $10 for members and $15 for non-members. The Gabriel Alves Jazz Trio will perform from 7 to 9 p.m. Saturday at River Hops Brewing, 1014 Central Avenue. In Moreland, the Webster County Conservation Department and the Iowa Department of Natural Resources are holding a trout stocking and fishing clinic 11 a.m. Saturday at the Moreland Park. This is a good opportunity for taking kids or novice anglers fishing, as trout tend to be readily available after they are stocked. Dress warmly, bringing youngster fishing, and enjoying fun on the ice. Beginners can learn about ice safety, cold weather clothing, fishing basics, and possible fish cleaning. Staff will be available to teach beginners. The Kendall Young Library, Webster City, will present the movie Smallfoot from 10:30 a.m. to noon on Saturday at the library. Jamphonica artist Freak Bass will perform at 8 p.m. today at Brian's in Pomeroy. The Otho United Methodist Church annual soup supper is from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Saturday at the church. Chili, chicken, noodle, vegetable, beef, cheesy potato soups, relish bars, and drinks will be served for a free will offering.
Okay, folks, one more winter storm warning in effect. And looking out our windows here, it looks like the snow has begun. Current weather forecasts indicate a winter storm warning. Accumulations of up to 2 inches or more of snow is possible through Saturday. Because weather can change abruptly, residents are encouraged to stay tuned to local weather forecasts. Due to the impending weather warning, residents are reminded that a parking prohibition will automatically go into effect on all residential emergency snow routes when there has been an accumulation of 2 inches or more of snow. The parking prohibition, I'm sorry, will be in effect until 24 hours after the snow stops falling. To review a map of all emergency snow routes, please visit the city's webpage at https://www.fortdodgeiowa.org/. For those people who are not on snow routes, please park your car off the street if possible, as it will be easier to plow all streets. You may park across a sidewalk or on the parking right of way until the snow has been cleared. Residents are encouraged to use caution when driving.
Crews round up over 1,700 piglets after semi overturns. This is from Des Moines. Authorities in Iowa had to round up more than 1,700 young pigs who were in a semi-trailer that overturned Thursday on a freeway just north of Des Moines. The crash happened at 1:30 p.m. when the truck overturned on a ramp to Interstate 35. Iowa State Patrol troops had to close the ramps at times as crews worked to capture and unload hundreds of pigs. The Iowa Department of Public Safety said in a tweet, authorities working to corral and transport 1,738 piglets. It's unclear how long the delays would take.
That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger. We thank the folks at Friendship Haven for giving Iris a home in Fort Dodge for so many years, and we thank you for listening with Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, wishing you all a dream to bless and a star to guide.